go ahead and welcome us and gather us, even though I know a couple of people are still on their way because I've sent them on errands, and I think they will come back to join us. It is a delight to have a second chance to be with some of you, and a very first chance to greet others of you and to invite you into an ongoing conversation. For those of you who weren't at the first session, don't worry. This is a flowing stream, and it will now be better and wiser for your presence. And you're not behind, and you don't have remedial homework. You get to step in right where we are and be part of the conversation this evening. And then if you're able to come back and want to come back, you can do sessions 3, 4, and 5, depending on how long you're here in the village. I'm Patricia Lull, and I'm a newbie at Holden Village. Arrived on Saturday, so this is all kind of, I'm kind of one of the starstruck, what is this? This is amazing. First-time visitors. A number of you have already been very, very, very helpful to me in terms of pointing me in the right direction for things or showing me the Holden way of doing any number of things. Holden is an excellent context to talk about discipleship in the particular angle of vision that we're using in these gatherings, because when I say the Holden way, I see a number of you nodding your heads. There's a certain way things are done, a way of life at Holden Village, and we can use that as a reference point in our sessions. I believe we're being recorded, and I think I was to say that this is session 2, and that the theme is prayer. We'll see if that's true at the end of the hour, that did turn out to be the theme. Oh, thank you, Carol. There were a whole stack across the way. Carol will get those passed out for those who would like another copy. And friends, I think we have plenty of copies, so if you have a friend who's not here who likes to read, take 2, and or take some on the way up.
Is this what we picked up yesterday?
This is yesterday's reading. But again, if you have 2 copies, share it with somebody else. A lot of good readers at Holden Village. I want to do just a quick coming back to a definition. As I said to in the first session, this is a definition I've crafted. I'm not deeply wed to it, and if a better definition emerges in our time together, I'm happy to erase and add and edit. But for those of you who like to begin a session thinking, well, what is discipleship? Here's the definition I would put before you. Discipleship is a way of life in which we point to the gospel of Jesus Christ with the whole of our lives. And at least for now, that's going to be our working definition. And we're going to do 3 activities this evening to put this definition to the test by putting it up against some kind of story. And the first story that we're going to look at is one from Mark chapter 5. A few of you had a head start because I mentioned that in the first session, and maybe you looked at the text. And after we do an activity with that Bible text, we're going to turn to the excerpt from the novel Lying Awake. And a couple of you are going to be surprised to find yourselves public readers, or maybe I'll be quite a reader if I read it all myself. And then we're going to move our discussion in the third section of the evening to thinking about what would it mean to have a way of life in which prayer was a very important part of orienting life, in that pointing to Jesus Christ, but also pointing to Jesus Christ in a way that was for the sake of the world. So let's see what we can do together on that. Anything I've missed moving from session 1 to session 2? Christos Michael is with us, our Bible study leader for the week. And I have to say, part of the richness of the way of life at Holden is even if you're a presenter, you go to a session and it just messes up your head. There are new ideas, new questions. And Michael was kind enough this earlier today in the Bible study to suggest that maybe I could unravel some of those threads that have been spun out there on vocation. I want to say I'm so glad my people are here to help with that weaving. We'll see how that goes this evening. But let's take a look at Matthew 5. Mark. Mark 5. And I wanted to begin with a little bit of a warning. Some of you who didn't know we were going to look at this text, I just know you're going to be distracted. It's like the accident 5 miles ahead on the highway and the warning sign saying, do not slow down, no rubbernecking. And as soon as you see this, the lights and the commotion, all cars pause to look off to the side. In this text, there are very provocative images of an exorcism and the economic implications for a herd of swine. I just want to say there'll be about 5 minutes to be curious about that part, but that's actually the distraction at the side of the road for where we're going on this trip. You're allowed to be curious, but we're not going to pause too long. I'm looking for one or two readers. Great. If you'd either read the whole of the verses 1 through 20 or wear out and somebody else will pick up. Thank you.
They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when he had stepped out of the boat, immediately a man ran out of the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. He lived among the tombs, and no one could restrain him anymore. Even with a chain. For he had often been restrained with shackles and chains, but the chains he wrenched apart, and the shackles he broke in pieces, and no one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always howling and bruising himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and bowed down before him, and he shouted at the top of his voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he had said to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." He begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now there on the hillside, a great herd of swine was feeding, and the unclean spirits begged him, "Send us into the swine, let us enter them." So he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the swine. And the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank and into the sea, and were drowned in the sea. The swineherds ran off and told it in the city and in the country. Then people came to see what it was that had happened. They came to Jesus and saw the demonic sitting there, clothed in his right mind, the very man who had had the legion, and they were afraid. Those who had seen what had happened to the demoniac and to the swine reported it. Then they began to beg Jesus to leave their neighborhood. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed by the demons begged him that he might be with him. But Jesus refused and said to him, "Go home to your friends. Tell them how much the Lord has done for you and what mercy he has shown you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone was amazed.
Thank you so much. Let's take a couple of minutes just to be curious. There are things in the text I bet you want to say something about, and if it's a question, you can ask a question of the group, but maybe there's just something you've noticed, or maybe even for a long time that you've thought about with this text. Anything you want to put before the whole group?
A stupid question, but who's going to eat the pork?
It's a great question. Let's go a little deeper. Say why you're curious about that, because readers through the centuries have been curious about that. What is it about pork that's right now on your mind?
Well, the Jews didn't eat pork.
Yes.
And I don't think that the Muslim religion hadn't begun, but I think mm-hmm. that injunction against pork had been pretty generalized in that area.
So we have a story that certainly is not speaking to the Jewish mainstream unless it's trying to poke at them in a mm-hmm. sense to get their attention. And it's really a story about outsiders. Yeah. Not only the way that the demon possession has made this one individual an outsider, but we're in a very different region, that whole sense of the pork, and then the economic loss
right.
of the pork.
So,
yeah, it wasn't. It's actually a pretty good question about. Oops, there's a cost to all this. What else has makes you curious in this text? Please.
The man says his name is Legion, and then later it sounds like it's a disease. You know, it's capitalized yeah. and it's lowercase, yeah. and he said he had the Legion.
Yeah. Any thoughts about? Anybody have thoughts about what's going on with the language there?
I guess he was referring to the spirits. In you know. His own and these other demon spirits.
It's a kind of poetic answer. It's also a military term. He's giving, some scholars would say he's actually it's a kind of layer thinking about Roman troops woven into the story. Again, like the pig, something that would resonate in some hearers' minds, but also a sense of very many. So it's not your ordinary response, what is your, my name's Patricia, my name is Sarah, my name is George, but rather my name is Legion, a kind of giving a poetic answer to them. But what else catches, it's an incredible 20 verses. What else has caught your attention?
It talks about the swineherd running off into mm-hmm. the city. What is a swineherd? I was thinking the swine were in a herd, but... is it a swine herder?
Yes, yes.
Running off
yeah.
into the city.
Yeah. The person in charge who now has to account for having lost.
All
and that, again, that's kind of funny language. It's not ordinarily how we speak of swine. So a lot of wrinkles in this story that would signal that this is one of the more incredible, extended, detail-oriented exorcisms in Scripture. Please.
Just a question. It mentions at the very end Decapolis. Mm-hmm. Is that a specific town? Or
it's actually a region. And some of you, your Latin is as good as mine. Ten cities. So a regional term. Anything else that you're really curious about, please?
I've never noticed that he's howling. You know, just that image of this guy out in the tombs howling. That's striking.
And I think most of you caught that or will now if you look back at the text, how isolated this man is. He is simply not able to live in his community. And that whole image of not being able to bear clothing or people or contain himself, a very, very powerful and provocative image. Now I want to invite us to look at 18 through 20. And to enter in the text in a different way, I'm going to ask you to be just looking at the people around you, to be in groups of four or five. And nobody's going to count, so if you're in a group of two or three, that will be okay. But find a couple of other people to talk to. And I want everyone from, I don't know what to do, I'm going to split you right down the middle. Everyone on this side, as you break into your groups, verses 18 through 20, you're going to think about what does discipleship mean, and you're going to focus on those friends back in the community, because this man is sent home to his friends. And what I want you and your small groups to think about is, what would you want to ask your former friend who's been off in the wilderness because he can't bear to be living in the community? What do you want to ask him, and then what else are you thinking that you're probably not brave enough to say to him? So this side of the room, you're going to think of it from the point of view of friends. And everybody from the split person, on, you're going to think of it from the point of view of the demoniac. When you go back to see those friends, Jesus sends you back to see the friends, what do you want to say to them? What do you have to say to them? And what would you like to say that maybe you're not going to put into words? What else are you thinking about your friends as you return to them? Okay? And you have about 5 minutes to do that and move around as you need to. We're going to hear from some of the groups. But let's take, to get totally back into the story, let's take a look again at verses 18 through 20. And we've had one great reader. How about a second reader for just that brief portion at the end? And again, thinking about what does it mean for the person in this story, verses 18 through 20, to be a disciple. Who will read those again? Please.
I can. And he was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed, and was entreating him that he might accompany him. And he did not let him, but he said to him, "Go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled.
Thank you. Verse 18, what does the person think? Are there clues about what discipleship might mean? What does the person want to do?
Follow Jesus.
And what's follow Jesus mean in this case?
Literally.
Get in the boat, go wherever Jesus goes. And what's the, and then many of us would say, wow, that's discipleship, follow me. What's Jesus up to? Because what's the answer isn't come along in the boat. What's the answer instead?
The answer is go and tell.
Go and tell.
And go where?
To your friends.
Go back home to the people you know, not just family, but that wider circle of people, and to do what? Tell what?
Tell them what's
miracle.
What's happened in your own life, the kind of testimony you're going to bear. Let's hear from the friends. I think that's this side of the room. A couple of responses. If you're a friend of the formerly possessed by demons person who now shows up back in the community, dressed and in his full mind and calm and now bearing testimony to Jesus, what do you want to ask that friend? Please.
Well, we kind of talked about wanting to ask how it happened, first of all, but then mostly, what led him come back to good health? What led him return to the company of people?
So looking for an explanation. From some other groups of, from the friend's perspective, other things you thought about that the friends might want to ask of the person?
How long is this going to last?
Yeah.
if they've seen him go so far down.
Very helpful, because we know it was, you picked up on that, the language of the howling. This was an extreme case, and so that, is this for keeps, this restored health? Anything else that friends might want to ask, or they might be thinking and be too polite to ask?
I want to ask, are you pissed off at us for leaving you out there in the desert?
So, and say a little bit more about that, why it might be in the, when the man is restored to his community, why that might be in their mind.
Well, because now he can remember.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Now we can be held, now I can be held accountable. Whereas before, he wasn't in his right mind, and so I could just push him to the margins and ignore him and not feel bad about it. Well, maybe not real bad.
So, in a sense, the move into discipleship may not be received so smoothly by the people back home. Amazement? But it could also have some undercurrents of not only is this durable, is this permanent, is this just a temporary state, but then also for the man, what were you thinking when we all abandoned you there, when you were beyond our scope to help? Very helpful. Anything else you think might be in people's minds, but they wouldn't necessarily be saying it out loud?
It said that they went back, that the swine herders went back. And so there was economic loss, and so there would be some, probably, for those impacted by this loss, I should think there would be some hard feelings.
Yes, and in fact, we see by the end of the story that while the man can go back to his community, Jesus is now the outcast. So again, this is not a smooth terrain. Let's turn this evening to those who thought about things more from the man's perspective. What do you want to say to your old friends? And also, what are you thinking but maybe not voicing? Please.
What kind of friend? You're calling me a friend? You got to be kidding. Who are you to say that you're my friend?
Okay, so some of...
Well, some of the reflection back
the
of
same
this.
Thing.
Yeah, you know, we're... So.
So we might imagine that there are relationships that need to be restored, right. Although in the text, we're not told what happens in the next chapter, in the chapter of the man's return. How about some other things from the man's perspective, either voiced or...
The level of excitement of being able to come home and say what's happened to me and who did it.
Can you think? Can anyone think of comparable stories of homecoming in Scripture? Sure. If we think, and this is also a homecoming story about restoration of, and not just I think for the man, but for the whole community, gets to be the whole community. Again, I don't know that that all happens right away without some work and some time elapsing, but it is a journey back to one's home. Territory is part of discipleship. What else would the man what would he say? What account do you think he would give to explain what had happened to him?
We talked about the difficulty that he faced going back to these friends who can loosely be called friends when you're cast out into the hills for all these years. Who knows how he was surviving, whether he was getting support from them or not, but there's a chasm there that requires some forgiveness and some differences in approach that I'm sure would be rumbling through his mind when he has this mission. But the joy of the proclamation, when they say they're amazed, shows that the joy and the effervescence of being healed, and he already recognized Jesus as the Messiah, which...
Right.
Which is something to me, the person who has all the demons recognizes Jesus as Messiah right away when some of the disciples didn't recognize him when he came back from the dead. You know, I mean,
a characteristic all through Mark's gospel. It's those who you wouldn't imagine could know what's going on who break the word. Please.
The man didn't know.
No, the legion knew.
The
right. There's something more powerful at work, although... What do you think? Would the man be able to give an account? Would he be able to point to what Jesus had done for him?
Probably.
I think Mark sets it up for us to think he's able to go home.
Even though Jesus had done it, but it was Legion who knew it was the
Christ. Jesus was.
This happens that Legion was in the body, so kind of like a schizophrenic, you know, it's kind of the hearing the voices or multiple personality disorder or something, as though that they're a part of you but not. Yeah. So it was Legion, that personality, the little ones who knew and said so. So here is the person, the actual person, might be going, he's what? You know, and it's like, wasn't me, but that didn't come out of my mouth. That was somebody else that said that. And so now he might be questioning, you know, like, well, this is what Legion said, and they're gone now. So, but I remember what he said came out of my mouth, but wasn't me. Who is this Jesus? He might know what Jesus did and want to follow him, but he's not maybe quite so sure who exactly.
But he would also know how his own life had been changed and restored. The wearing of clothes, the being able to go back home, in a sense being inside himself again. Other things you want to say from the man's point of view, that either things that were voiced or, we'll start here and then in the back.
I would even say that the man might say, you know, if you don't believe me, just test me. You know, I hear it said, just try to piss me off and see if I and see how I respond to that.
I think he would say just what Jesus told him to say. Tell them how much the Lord has done for you and what mercy he has shown you. That's the word that he's given, which is a transformative word to the community. The sick man goes to the sick community. The sick man now healed goes to the sick community with the healing word.
Yes, and that that sense of mercy that's not just for one person but back to the community. And Mark is going, it implies that this is now going to be a traveling truth teller. As a discipleship going around to the cities. Anything else you want to say today about the text before we move on to another way of thinking from this story? Please.
Is it feasible to think that the devil, perhaps evil, responsible, certainly recognized Jesus? So you know you go back to the desert experience, and certainly the desert, I mean the devil is aware of the Son of God being there, and there is some recognition of that, and so I'm wondering if the same thing is happening here.
In a variety of the gospel stories, we have the higher powers being on to more of the higher consequences of what's unfolding in the life of Jesus. Carol?
I'm wondering about the effect of this on the community of friends and then those around them. Because, I mean, they were astonished, they were surprised, but was there any recognition that this is something that I want a part of too? I mean, was that kind of, I want some of that? Or,
any clues in the text?
I didn't hear the question.
What happens to the people back home? Do they also want to know more about this Jesus? Do they also want to be healed in a similar way? Are there any clues in the text?
Yeah, they want Jesus to leave fast. Okay.
We've got this push-pull. Jesus is off now. I mean, in a sense, cast away.
Well, the framework of them being amazed is the language of that is there's an intrigue and an inquiry.
Yes.
That they're wanting to, that's built into that term, and wanting to be able to try to satisfy out of their amazement.
My take on Mark's gospel, and maybe it reflects more my experience than Mark's experience, or the community gathered around Mark, it's a great catechetical text. It's a great teaching gospel, because I think so many of the stories leave us saying, well, then what happened to those people? And the very next logical question is, well, what would happen to you now that you've heard this testimony? So I could make a case that within the text we're shown what happens to those people. But the fact, Carol, that you voiced that question, I think that's exactly where the narrative wants to lead us, is to that question. So what difference for the people around the one healed? We're going to, if you stick with Mark's gospel, which we won't necessarily in these sessions, but you're allowed to do that on your own, you'll see how the numbers of those who join into the conversation, into the inquiry, into the momentum, expands as the gospel goes forward, and then it shrinks right down at the time of the Passion. But we're still fairly early in Mark's gospel, and I think Carol's question, in a sense, is one of our questions to carry forward. What difference does it make to each of us when we hear this testimony of what God's mercy is able to do? Please.
And Mark ends in 16:8 with the women fleeing the tomb with terror and amazement.
The two
same
being right
word,
there.
Amazement.
Yeah. Yeah.
At the possibility that Jesus has defeated death.
And think of those as very powerful aspects of all discipleship, including your own amazement and your own terror at some of the things you may now have been drawn into by the call of the gospel. Okay, I think we're going to shift gears, and are you going to shift gears with me?
Sure.
I'm kind of broken transmission. I better be careful of that, using that analogy. What we're going to do is I'm going to pray that the Holy Spirit will hover over two of you who will come and help me with a reading of an excerpt from a novel. It's the novel Lying Awake, which is a very contained story. It's about, I think, a dozen characters in the entire novel, because it is set in a cloistered women's religious community. And so it's only the nuns and a couple of other characters who appear, but in a very small community, one of the women, Sister John, begins after a time of real struggle in her own life, a kind of dry spiritual time, to be blessed with a flood of incredible visions and a sense of closeness and intimacy with God. This has, in many ways, been an answer to a prayer of many years. But at the same time, there are some other symptoms with this that eventually lead her to a neurologist. And it turns out that she has a tumor behind her ear. And the question is, will she have the tumor removed and probably not have that sense of intimacy and closeness to God as a consequence? Or will she hold on to the tumor because the way that it floods her experience with what she's been longing for in her relationship with God? And the particular excerpt that we're going to do as a bold public reading, impromptu public reading tonight, is happens in one evening. Sister John has decided this is the evening of destiny that she will decide now. Surgery yes or surgery no. And her whole life of contemplative prayer, her own relationship with God has led to this moment. Now, let me see. Are there two very brave readers? You don't have to read much, but it will make it a more enjoyable experience if there would be two people willing to read. And I have marked text so that you would know what you're going to read. I need a yellow reader who gets to be one of the woman abbess, if you'd come forward. And I have not many lines. A few of them are in Latin, but nobody's going to scold if your Latin isn't up to par. Would there be another reader for the green part? Great. And again, absolution, the Latin phrase, Carl, I want to say, is all going to come out of the compline service. So think liturgically, it's all prayers to God. And the three of us are going to do this reading together. Many of you have copies and you can follow along. What I'd like you to think about is for this nun, and in the next 8 pages, you're going to have some feel for her, even if you haven't read ahead. What does discipleship mean, and what role does prayer play in her discipleship? And once we've read this, we'll use our remaining time to wrap up with that question. She opened her eyes. When had she at last closed them? She was lying down. She had on her white mantle, the special garment they wore for Mass, but she was not in choir.
Are you awake, sister?
Where am I?
You're in the infirmary. You became ill. We had to bring you here to rest.
Mother Emmanuel looked tired, tired love. Sister Teresa stirred in the next bed. She looked bleached like a piece of driftwood.
Father Aaron explained your condition to me, sister. He had to, under the circumstances. I explained it to the others.
We are as God made us, Mother.
Mother Emmanuel sighed.
After your seizure, you were telling us how beautiful the view was, how beautiful everything was. Do you remember saying that?
Yes. The only word I will ever need again. Every breath, a yes. Every thought, a yes.
Have you thought about the view, what the view looked like at the rest of us, sister?
My trust in God alone.
Perhaps you aren't aware of yourself during those moments.
The prioress continued.
Just when God offered himself to us through the Eucharist, you stood up and began wandering around the choir, staring at the ceiling and humming to yourself. If Sister Christine hadn't gotten to you in time, you might have walked into the screen and knocked it over. Do you remember any of that?
Sometimes when we follow God, we appear to cause others to suffer. God plans everything down to the smallest detail.
The prioress rose from the chair next to the bed.
I'd like you to stay here for the rest of the day. We'll talk about this more tomorrow. In the meantime, try to get as much rest as you can.
Sister John looked at the crucifix over the door for encouragement, but instead saw rebuke. Now that the brilliance of her seizure had faded, doubt lost its shadow appearance and became solid again. The horizon between reality and illusion, between the spiritual and the material, between faith and self-interest, between love and self-love, vanished. Too restless to stay in bed, but forbidden to leave the infirmary, she pulled a chair up to the window and stared out at the garden. I must stay calm, she thought. As long as I'm more careful from now on and go to my cell as soon as I feel a headache coming, I won't disturb the others again. It will mean more absences from choir, but quality of time given to God is what counts, not quantity. What if the seizures become more frequent or more severe? What if I'm not able to work in the kitchen or answer the turn or do my share of cleaning? How much inconvenience am I willing to impose on the others before wondering if this is really God's will after all? Pineapple sage grew at the base of the fountain. The narrow crimson blossoms reminded her of the wounds on Christ's body. Doubt is inevitable, she told herself. Sister Teresa of Avila was tormented by doubts right up until the end of her life, but she did not give in. She knew that it was better to have a dream and pay a price for it than to be lukewarm. Sometimes the price of following a dream includes confusion. In her diaries, Teresa often wrote, "I don't know what to do." Sister John thought, "I can't bear the thought of going back to who I was before. I prayed and scrubbed and went through the motions with no feeling of love, only a will to keep busy. If the surgery were to take my dream away, everything I've gone through up to now would seem meaningless. I wouldn't even be able to draw inspiration from the memory of it. I couldn't face the desert again, not this late in my life. But what is my dream? Is it really to know God, or is it to know personal happiness?" Didn't Teresa also warn that the price of following a dream includes painful setbacks, even having to start all over again? Sometimes it means facing things we think we can't face, to learn the depth of God's mystery and our need for faith. My God, I feel as if I am being torn apart. That evening, the air was especially dry and still. When Sister John opened the infirmary window, she could hear her sisters chanting the night office as clearly as if they were chanting in the courtyard.
"You have taken away my friends and made me hateful in their sight. Imprisoned, I cannot escape. My eyes are sunken with grief."
She formed a mental picture of the choir with all the lights turned off except for the vigil lamp at the altar and the candle illuminating the Virgin Mary's shrine. The liturgy built to a cadenza on the two sides of the choir alternated vows of submission to God's will, then halted as the sisters took up their instruments of penance.
"Alma Redemptoris Mater, qua pervia Caeli."
Every Saturday evening, the sisters bared their left shoulder for the chanting of the Miserere, an ancient psalm of repentance. The knotted leather cords of the discipline whistled through the air, then struck flesh. With each blow, the sisters prayed for the exaltation of the church, for peace on earth, for the souls in purgatory, for those in the state of sin, and for all men and women in captivity. It was not enough to be sorry for past offenses, or simply to forget them. The sisters came to Carmel to make reparation, not only for their own sins, but for every sin ever committed. Penance stripped them of self-will and self-love, not as an end in itself, but as a means of clearing away all obstructions to the love of God.
Peccatorium miserere.
When the poem ended, the monastery entered the great silence. The nuns would be covering their shoulders and rising from their stalls. Sister John listened as 8 pairs of sandals brushed across the floor on their way to the dormitory. She waited until she heard the caller deliver the retiring sentence in the dormitory.
"But those things I used to consider gain, I have now reappraised as loss in the light of Christ."
After the final clap of wood, she slipped out of the infirmary. Alone in the choir, she noticed that everything looked flat and insubstantial. The cross above the altar looked like a fresco on the wall, the vigil lamp like a photograph of a candle. She knelt before the Eucharist, but did not pray in words. She maintained a spirit of humility and expectancy, but did not ask for anything. She felt she no longer had a right to ask God for favors. When her legs hurt too much to kneel anymore, she sat in her stall. She did not allow herself to consider going back to the infirmary, because to retreat into the oblivion of sleep would not have been to let her spirit die. She was prepared for the struggle of her life. She would not leave the room until she had decided either for or against surgery and was prepared to live with the consequences. Jesus faced his most difficult trial, his moment of doubt, alone. He had asked his disciples to watch and pray in the garden with him. they'd all succumbed to the weakness of the flesh and fallen asleep. When the soldiers came, the disciples were surprised and fled in confusion. Because they had not watched with Jesus, they were not ready to suffer, die, and rise with him. Sister John bared her shoulder and struck herself with the discipline several times in an attempt to shake off exhaustion. But she was fighting a losing battle. At the point when she felt she was about to fall asleep, she whispered,
"I'm sorry."
Her thoughts began to unravel. Then a hand touched her shoulder, pulling her together again. Someone had entered the choir so quietly she hadn't heard. Mother Mary Joseph signed, "I watch for you. Rest." The living rule sat down in her stall, back bent but spirit alert. It was clear she was capable of sitting through the night and that she intended to. Sister John resumed her vigil, feeling her strength return. The two nuns did not look at each other, but an understanding passed between them and held. They became like two life rafts lashed together on the sea. After an hour, Mother Mary Joseph suddenly stood. She did not look tired, but after paying her respects at the altar, she left the choir. A moth, attracted by the vigil lamp, spiraled toward it as if it were trapped in an invisible nautilus. Just when it seemed sure to destroy itself on the flame, it looped out to begin a new orbit. Footsteps approached the choir. The living rule returned to her stall holding a candle, followed by Mother Emmanuel. Within a few minutes, the entire community, all holding candles, rallied to keep watch with Sister John. Their presence turned night into day, midnight sun at the end of the earth. Nothing was said, but the message was clear. A sister might feel lost, but she was never alone. When she first became a contemplative, Sister John had envisioned a relationship to souls in need. The foundation of religious life, after all, is a commitment to look beyond oneself. She prayed for the souls of the world every day and assumed her efforts made a difference. When it came to her sisters, however, who were also souls in need, but whose troubles could not be visualized away so easily, she had been stingier, more guarded. She had never really done anything for them that didn't serve her own interest. Yet here they were, staying up all night with her so that she wouldn't have to struggle alone. She had failed to discern God's will in the matter of whether or not to treat her disorder. She had seen today how her seizures could become a burden to her sisters. To give up her ecstasies for their sake would be, if not a spiritual decision, at least an honorable one. She looked around the room and tried to etch the scene in memory, praying that whatever her future might be, God would reward her sisters for their generosity of spirit. She rose, bowed to them as a signal that her vigil was over, and returned to the infirmary.
Thank you, God, and forgive me.
What's it mean, thinking about Sister John, in the story we've stepped into, and the community of sisters around her? What does discipleship mean? There are clues in this text.
It's largely prayer and keeping the discipline.
So partly it's the structure of every day, and I think here at Holden, fair to say there's a Holden way of daily discipline, of prayer and worship and anything that pushes on that definition of discipleship as the story unfolds?
The tension of personal and communal.
Yeah, and talk about that tension in this particular text.
Well, she had her own experience of God, mm-hmm. and ultimately chose to honor the blessings in the community and potentially giving up or having consequence on her own experience.
And at least what I take to be very powerful, this tension between her own desire for an intimate relationship with God and realizing the cost, but also the witness of the community. Other things that are in your mind and imagination, having heard a second text this evening, in terms of the role of prayer and community and yearning to be close to God?
I think community is an incredibly important, maybe the most important aspect of life. And I'm not sure it's honored enough. Because every one of us lives in a community somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that's, and sometimes the community can't let you down. Mm-hmm. Other times the community uplifts you. And, you know, I think that, you know, you looked at the man with the demons, and he had completely lost community.
In whatever way that community could not hold him, in this case, Sister John's community found an incredible way to hold the one who was actually causing them great aggravation and pain.
And they found strength as a community by doing that.
Other images that stick with you from the two, and particularly the play of the two texts? Yes.
I think she was agonizing about how much value this intimate relationship God had if it alienated her from the community.
And yet,
what was it worth? Even though it was.
And it, she thought it was what she wanted for all of her life.
Yeah.
That phrase, it comes pretty early on. I can't start over at this age. I can't learn a new way in a disciple. I think some of us, the generations in this room, some of us may read that a little bit differently than others. Other images about prayer and community that you are now thinking about this evening?
I thought it was interesting how they all came to be there for her without saying a word.
And have some of you read this novel? Would it be fair to say by this point in the story, she's not the easiest member of the community? In fact, I don't think there are any easy members of that community or any other real-life community I've ever met, but Sister John has kind of estranged herself from those who gather, and I think you catch hints of that even in this excerpt, that some pretty amazing people show up first as the night unfolds, but then that they all rise from sleep to come and sit with the one who has made life most difficult and cumbersome.
Is this supposed to be, I think you said it was a novel, so it's fiction, it's not
real.
That's real, but it's fiction.
Let me make another turn so that we're thinking about our own lives, and one of the great things both about the stories in Scripture and the stories on handouts, they can go with us and you can have a second chance to look back at text or talk about those. I think one of the phrases, and I know it comes out of my mouth, I imagine it comes out of yours. I say to others, I'll pray for you, or you are in my prayers. And I think, to go back to the definition of discipleship that's there about way of life, one of the faith practices challenges for discipleship that is for the sake of the world, is to figure out how to give some liveliness to those phrases that roll off our tongues. I will pray for you, or you are in my prayers. Some of you may, I think, probably have examples of how you or others around you, particularly as part of a community, have incorporated prayer that has some depth to it, so it isn't just a statement, I will pray for you. And I wonder if any of you would like to give if you have an example from back home, the way that prayer is part of your discipleship, not only for you, but in your home setting. Anybody venture a prayer discipline that you would share with this group?
Well, I have a really odd thing. I'm a member of a community online.
Huh?
And we are a tight community. Most of us have never met anybody else in that community. We share an interest that has nothing to do with religion. As a matter of fact, we have a pact. We don't talk about religion.
But if somebody voices a concern, others will pray.
We have become very close in lifting up members in prayer. And it is almost daily that someone will request prayer because they know that in this group, even those who don't have a particular faith will hold them in the kind of thought that is really prayer.
So in the 21st century, we can have these virtual communities where prayer is real, and if you invite others to prayers, you can trust that the prayers are real. Excellent. Are there some other examples of ways that the practice of prayer has shaped a life of discipleship for you?
Well, one of the things that I try to do is not just say, I'll pray for you, but let's mm-hmm. pray right now together.
Okay. To remove that in the future, I will remember, I hope, to pray for you, but to do that. I think while we know, many of us would say prayer is right at the heart of our lives as Christians, it is one of the harder disciplines in the 21st century to think, what does that make sense? How do we go about that? Would there be any other stories to share this evening? Yeah.
Well, I think it's so rare to have people even talk about prayer and faith that by actually, by even saying, I'll pray for you, or you're in my prayers, that itself can be a transformative thing for someone. Because when I say that, sometimes I forget. I don't even think about it. And I feel guilty about that. But there have been times when people have come back and said, I know you were praying for me. You know, and I think,
but
it
cracks
something
open.
It's hard to say. So that itself can be
But isn't
saying it
praying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you tell someone that you'll pray for them, that is a prayer.
Yes.
Yeah. Please.
I have a friend who done the prayer ministry. She's not Lutheran, and when she says she's going to pray for you, you know she's praying for you. And her sense of discipleship is very real. I wish I had that, just when you were saying about how hard that is. It's like, and she's always sending emails, please pray for so-and-so, condolences to privacy, you can't say just exactly what. And it's like when I ask her to pray for me, I fully expect she's going to pray for me. And when other people say, asked me and said, well, please pray for so-and-so. I'm like you. He's like, please pray for all the people that everybody said pray for me, because I don't remember who they are, but you know who they are. And I have a hard time. Prayer is hard, because in my community, in the Baptist church that I mostly go to, there's a list of people, and you have to write them down. And if you were going to pray for all the people that people want you to pray for, it would take at least an hour, you know, and then you're supposed to keep track of what the results were. That's hard work, you know, to do that. So while I really appreciate it when somebody says they're praying for me, and it means a lot to me, I have a hard time being a disciple in that same way for others.
I want to thank those of you who voiced how difficult this is, and I think in part it's more difficult in our time, in the 21st century, because we live in a much expanded world. The number of people we can know and bear concerns about. Those of you who were here yesterday received 5 big questions, and I think you might want to say, with regard to some of those, what's expected of in your own community of faith. To raise back up, raise the question about prayer, or as you leave this evening, as we go on to Vespers, many of you were here with others, maybe to have that be a quiet conversation with one another. It takes a kind of courage to say, yeah, what about prayer? Could that, how might that be more so a witness within our discipleship? Sonny mentioned an online community. I this is not my website, but I really like geraniumfarm.org, and I've printed out a copy so that you can see, as of 7309 at 5:23 p.m., Holden Village is being prayed for by those, this community that gathers, Geranium Farm. Barbara, I'll send this around, the living proof of the prayers. Barbara Crofton is an Episcopal priest who encountered some chronic health problems and was no longer able, this is all post September 11th, when she was right at Ground Zero, very active in the ministry in those early days. And so her ministry, what she felt had opened up to her, what God was calling her to, was some blogging, some daily devotions, but then also hosting a prayer ministry that began in part because she couldn't sleep through the night. And she wondered who else could keep vigil with her, and this, some of the prayer ministry has grown out of that. For those of you, when you're back home, if you like doing online things, take a look at geraniumfarm.org. But the papers will go around, and I'll think then of a place to post them, so others, if you can't, don't get to see them tonight, could linger with that. Let me say how much I appreciate your willingness to jump into several different texts, several questions. I hope, Michael, we've done justice to the ambiguity, the big question you put before us this morning about whether, to what degree our lives are changed, and whether we stay in the state that we're in, the status, or not. Because in today's story, both the biblical text and the literature that we read are examples of profound transformation in a person's life, and at least in that block of text that we were given, not absolutely clear that anybody left home, but home is seen in a brand new way because of the transformational experience, the encounter with Jesus Christ. For those of you willing to do homework, this particular, these sessions on discipleship, we don't convene again until Thursday. We're going to be a Thursday, Friday, Saturday morning group. But the text that I put before you for your own reading and preparation is Matthew 6, 19 and 20. It's just a little snippet there from chapter 6 of Matthew's Gospel. And actually, maybe it might be 21. I'm a little curious if that might not be a 1 instead of a 20. But when you get there, you'll know that you want to read the whole little section about your own heart and your own treasures. When we convene again on Thursday, we're going to think about what it means to be a neighbor. And I hope you sense there might be a little overlap from what it means to be a neighbor in a religious community, in a choir stall in the middle of the night, to what it means to be neighbor in a small community in Vermont. The story that we're going to read on Thursday, and some of you, whether you're going to be here on Thursday or choose to come, you're welcome to a story, and if we run out, I will run more copies and have them in the dining hall tomorrow. It's a passage by Katherine Patterson, a young adult book called The Same Stuff as Stars, and I would invite you to think about the role that the local librarian plays in this particular text. What's it mean to be neighbor as part of our discipleship? So I'll hand these to Jack by the door, and he'll be our handout person, or we'll put them on his seat so they get handed out. And I want to thank you for coming, and I know soon we will gather again at Vespers. Thank you much.